on a horizon to which they think we are entitled. But we are entitled only to the moment, and owe nothing to the future except that we follow our convictions. I am finally following mine. The desert taught me that the only path is forward.
"I left you a gift in your room," Clerastes says. "Something for the occasion."
He lingers on the shuttle steps, unwilling to say farewell. He nods, sets a hand on my shoulder, contemplates a parting word, and then enters the shuttle. Night comes, not soon enough. At 7 o'clock, Exeter's ship takes him down to the city, along with most of the servants, who are concealed in the cargo hold for their rendezvous with our loyalists. A skeleton crew remains behind. The guards are none the wiser. They watch me. At 8 o'clock, the clone program Glorastes' loyalist greens cooked up hijacks the feed from my security spike and transmits falsified data back to them, showing that I am in the library reading. I cut it out of my shoulder with a small knife from the dresser. Then I sit on the edge of the bed and take the card off the smoked glass box that Glorastes left for me. The note is simple. This summons legions. Inside the box is a silver horn, inlaid with gods and goddesses and racing chariots, with wild steeds pulling the sun. The horn of Helios, which has begun every race in the Hippodrome since it was built. It is a priceless relic. I set it on the bed as I open a second, far larger container that conceals the grav boots, razor, and military hardware provided by the loyalists. I'm about to slip the grav boots on when a knock comes at the door. I frown as a servant's voice comes through the oak.
"You have a visitor, my liege."
I open the door. "A visitor? What the devil do you mean?"
"Alexander our Arcos and his maid servant are in the atrium demanding to see you, Dominus."
Alexander? The timing could not be worse. I don't have time to wag jaws at the crown prince of the free legions as he thanks me for his deliverance.
"Tell him I am indisposed. He knows you are on house arrest. He can see you're in the library, Dominus."
He looks at the equipment laid out on the bed. "He will be suspicious if I send him away." That suspicion will lead to a cascade of consequences that may upturn the entire venture. I am supposed to be at the Hippodrome in 10 minutes. With Glorastes in motion, there is no secure way to alter the timetable. Damn it. "Admit him into the library in 2 minutes. Tell him I am finishing a chapter." I shut the door. There's absolutely nothing to be done about the spike. I have no way of contacting the Greens. I hide the loyalist razor in my boot and race to the library. I'm sweating by the time the door to the library bursts open, and Alexander waltzes in as if he owns the place. Behind him trails the child soldier, Rona. Darrow's niece gapes at all the books. I find her particularly offensive today. She wears her arms bare to show off the unnatural bolts that permit low colours to parody the blue mind sync with their vehicles. This condition, compounded by her colour's adverse disposition to disciplined warfare, creates anarchy in a single individual. A sort of dissociative mania, which I can see behind her eyes. A zealot, this one. I must tread carefully.
"This is where they keep the renegade libertines, in the library?" Alexander asks, running his tongue along his new teeth. "I hope it was an interesting chapter to keep us waiting, you tart."
He greets me like a brother, wrapping me in a hug and slapping my back in a sort of thuggish display of camaraderie.
"You may have heard," he goes on, "departure is imminent, and I told Rona it would be a crime against culture to depart without a tour of the Lady Beatrice. It will likely be months before we're back again."
Even the thought of the rising returning to claim Mercury sets my blood to a boil. "What a splendid idea," I say, before making an apologetic face. "But I fear I am rather indisposed at the moment."
"Told you we should have called ahead," Rona says.
She smiles apologetically at me.
"Sorry, lad, entitlement is one habit the man can't break."
"Our book is hardly as interesting company as we are," Alexander says.
He grins with his new teeth.
Fear not, good man. I know better than to insult local customs. I brought a bribe.
He tosses me a bottle and winks.
I hear Arabians simply adore Venusian brandy.
Chapter 79. Darrow. Bad blood. Fear stares at me through the glass. It does not seem as if he has moved since I resisted cutting off his hands. Hasn't talked a lick despite the cocktails, Screwface says from beside me. Neurological conditioning, I ask. If it is, it ain't like any I've ever seen. Atlas's side of the wall is blank, but I feel his eyes on me. I move left, and they follow. He can sense us. Screwface believes it. I noticed that too. Should we up the dosage? No. Darrow, we need to know when Atalantia will attack. She's in no hurry, I say. But if we kill him before we get him to my wife... I stop as I realize what I'm doing. It's always easier to plan on hope. If she's alive, she can crack him. When we get what's in there, we'll have a chance. Till then, let's not push our luck by melting his cerebellum. We're about to leave the cell behind when Atlas speaks.
Peticabere forsemel, sed idum, si deprensus erispis irrumabo, quod si tertia furta mulieris, ut poenam patiare et hanc et illam, peticaberis irrumaberesque.
What does it mean? Screwface asks. Fear is on the job. Come on! My family was full of pixies. Didn't ever bother with Latin.
I sigh and translate. Thief, for first thieving shalt be swived, but an again arrested shalt be irrumate, and shouldst attempt to plunder time the third, this and that penalty thou shalt endure, being both pedicate and irrumate.
I am going to kill that man, Screw says quietly. Get in line. Back in the mound, the final preparations for departure are underway. Despite Screwface's effective efforts against Atalantia's spy rings, it is best to assume she still has agents within the city. Tomorrow's evacuation to the ships will come as a surprise to all but those within my inner circle. Until then, my army plays the part of occupying force. Patrols continue, garages rattle with industry, barracks swell with music and snoring and gambling. Yet something feels wrong. The Fear Knight's poem has haunted me. Did I miss something? To allay my concerns, I took a tour of the mountain fortifications for signs of Atalantia's forward elements after visiting Atlas. All was still. Too still. Thraxa and Harnassus think my ill-ease to be general paranoia. Glerastes' work is completed. The Morning Star and the remaining ships are repaired for combat. Morale is high. My confidants dwell on the coming fray and debate our chances of slipping the noose. But in my quarters inside the mound, my mind roves restlessly as I inspect data packets from Atlas's interrogation, surveillance of known loyalists, and Glerastes' charge, Cato. The 5-minute gap from his detour to the wine cellar is explainable, yet cloying. In secret, my men bugged the cellar after that surveillance failure, and faulted it on interference from the Lady Beatrice's reactor. Arnassus himself has vouched for the integrity of Glerastes's EMP. So why do I linger over this insubstantial creature's idle days? Is it simply the seeds of fear? He has done nothing suspicious, not even left the Lady Beatrice, yet something is off about Cato au Vitruvius's nature, if not his actions. Perhaps it is latent sociopathic tendencies that set the hairs on my back standing on end. I watch him sit in the library reading his book,
and shift back through the moments where my greens flagged peculiar activity. Much is class-based misunderstanding. They divine malign intent from his reading selections and his ambivalence toward the names of the servants. False positives, perfectly in keeping with his nature. I should let it alone and not squander my time. But I find myself idiosyncratically flipping through his hours, unwilling to get out of my chair. I watch him walk the garden, laugh at old vids, converse with the guards, sketch idly the shadows of a lone flower, eat breakfast, yawn over evening drinks with Clearastes, retire to bed at a drunkard's hour. A knock comes at my door. I let the video continue playing and answer. Thraxa stands there with her hands behind her back. Did you eat dinner? Ration bars don't count. She produces 2 fish pies. Come on in. She tosses them on the table and looks around for plates. We're both just going to eat them all anyway, I say. She shrugs and plops down in a chair, digging into hers with a utility knife. She waves the knife at the hollow. That's a little creepy, watching the pixie sleep. If you're so fond of him, you should have gone with the kids. The kids? Alexander and Rona went up to the Beatrice not long ago. Why? Something about a gift. That troubles me. I wouldn't have stopped it. I have no valid reason. Yet Thraxa senses my unease. What's wrong? She asks. Something's not been sitting right, I say. There's something about him. Then let's bring him in. Harnassus says the MP is flawless, and we're jamming any signal that leaves the peninsula just as much as Atalantia is. If he's a spy, I don't know what the hell he's doing. She forks a piece of fish into her mouth. You want to talk about it? It? Your wife. My brother. Maybe the rest of my family. No. I watch her. Do you want to talk about it? Nah, not my bag. But it ain't fun, is it? No, it ain't fun. There's an indistinct murmur from the hollow. Wait. I fix on the hollow as Thraxa frowns. What's the matter? Quiet. I amplify the sound and replay the murmur Cato made as he slept. Did you hear that? I ask. Sounds like something over all. Truth over all, I say. I've heard that before. But when? When? I can't pin my finger on it until a slippery sensation works its way up my arm. I bolt upright and run to the door. Your pie! Thraxa calls after me. I stand over the science team as they shake their heads at my request for a DNA check. We've been under constant attack since we got to Mercury, sir. There's no DNA census without a re-upload from Skyhall, and we ran him against all the gold POWs. Run it against this. I thrust Sevro's trophy at them. The tech looks down at the bloody robes in confusion. Now! I pace behind the techs as they work. It does not take long. The computer beeps, and before I look up, I know. The DNA is related. Oh, shit, I hear the tech say as I bolt out of the room so fast I send Thraxa tumbling over a chair. I call Screwface at full sprint. He answers, covering his yawn with his Heliopolitan scarf, having just returned from a patrol in the mountains. Iron up, full pack. His face falls as he knows he failed. They're coming. They're coming. Next, I call Harnassus. He answers peevishly from the Morning Star. Are you with Clearastes? His weariness vanishes. No. His shuttler's having maintenance difficulties. Tell him I want to speak with him in the hangar. Once he's away from the machine, stun him, strip him naked, scan him for embeds, and put him in a cell with a full sentry standing guard. No one is to speak with him until I get there. If he tries to touch anything unusual between this moment and then, shoot him in the head.
Then order an evacuation of all support personnel to the ships. I want everyone except combat ready to go. I take a breath. Then get a particle beam pointed at the spirit of Faran and blow that EMP to hell.
There's a pause.
Copy that. What's what?
Patching a pool.
I use my master controls over my Howler's network as I run, cutting out Alexandra and Rona. Colloway joins from the confines of his isolation chamber. Thraxa storms down the hall to link up with me. Harnassus joins as he walks a complaining Glerastes out to the hangar. When the rest of the pool has joined from all across Heliopolis, I inform them and my private horror becomes real. An Omega-level enemy asset has been discovered inside the city. Glerastes has flipped. That EMP is for us. I've ordered its destruction, but it will be coordinated with an outside assault. Prepare for heavy enemy contact. Attack is imminent.
Should I call Rona and Alexander?
Will it tip my enemy off? If I don't, he could take either of them hostage, or kill them if he hears us coming. I have to risk it and trust their discretion. Even then, if anyone could take down a single man, it's Alexander. I use my master command to turn on both of their cochlear implants. Rona is laughing and admiring the water colossus.
Do not react. A Howler strike team is on its way to your location. The man you are sitting across from is not named Cato Au Vitruvius. He is Lysander Au Loon. Wait for us. Do not engage him on your own.
Chapter 80. Lysander, heir of Arcos. When I first saw the water colossus, I thought nothing could be that big. Rona admires the 10-meter-tall model inside Glerastes' museum to himself. But then I thought I'd never seen anything as big as Tinos, or the Citadel of Light, or the Morning Star. That shit nearly dropped my jaw. There's always something bigger, ain't there? She is much like her name, which means Rough Island in ancient Gaelic. I doubt she knows how apt a name it is. The young red wants to be inviting, but just can't help being jagged around the edges. Alexander does not notice the jaggedness one bit. Starlight filters through the glass dome, the light of certain stars amplified to cast columns of light over the models. From his recline on a bench, Alexander sips his sherry and gazes at the rough island as if she were the monument itself. Their unspoken tenderness seems already so frail to me. Before the ash rain, it wouldn't have.
Nothing is as big as the Morning Star, my good lady, except the ego of the Valley I Wrath, Alexander says, enjoying his role as tour guide.
It seems his education stumbled during his house's sojourn from Mars to Io to Luna to Rebels. Even in my anxiousness to depart, I remind myself to be civil and correct none of his errors.
It took 7 years to build, dozens of asteroids, but most of its metal came from the mines of Mercury.
Wrong.
Gods, how long do they intend to loiter?
I hide my vexation. My men will already be in motion. Glerastes preparing his program.
I must get to the Hippodrome. But most galling of all, my two guests are becoming rude in their lingering. If this is what passes for Martian manners, I shudder to think of what Virginia has done to the Palatine.
My cousin's enthusiasm for seeing me again has made it impossible to extract myself from their company. Something must be done, and soon. Yet a fresh variable rears its ugly head. I've unfortunately noticed Alexander no longer tongues his new teeth as he did when he arrived.
From the mines here? No shit! Shipping fees must have put Octavia in her early grave, Rona says with a folksy whistle. Cost me half a month's pay just to send a kilogram of loot back to Mars. How am I supposed to get my cigars home?
She glances at me with a grin.
Raided the Votum Vault, I did.
You're looking at the only purveyor of Heliopolitan cigars in all Aegea.
Well, soon as we skip this rock and make like pups for home, that is.
She downs her glass, leaving fingerprints all over the bulb. Darrow's stock, indeed. Her other hand hangs idle at her side, no longer exhibiting the tick of playing with the leather thong of her sidearm's holster. This, along with Alexander's diminished self-dentistry, has turned me cold. I probe with the mind's eye.
Octavia made the people of Mars subsidize it, Alexander explains. She wanted the Rim to build a flagship paid for by Mars, just to mock us, especially after Darrow purloined the Pax.
Not exactly true, I say. Octavia commissioned it 4 years before the Vanguard was stolen. She paid the Julii Trading Company the shipping fees, using the tariff revenues levied on Nero Augustus's helium exports from his mines, which your grandfather, Alexander, watched him steal from his sworn arch-governor. The rising plutocrats were willing beneficiaries of the society before they tired of it. In fact, I look at Rona. How many mines did your family own, Alexander? He smiles pleasantly back.
Oh, far fewer than yours, I assume.
I affect a yawn, and then resort to violence. I seize Rona's left wrist and jerk her toward me, so that my tight jab shatters her jaw. In the same moment I pull her slack body to me, strip her sidearm and put it to her temple. The tip of Alexander's whip stops taut, less than a centimetre from my right eye. He recalls it in a beautiful manoeuvre that has him poised for the falling leaf, a winding corkscrew of a downward slash. He shows remarkable mastery of one of the Willow Way's more complicated strikes by freezing halfway into the third motion. His eyes stare at the gun I hold to Rona's head. In the moment, there is no rage for me in my cousin's eyes, only fear for her. I do not want to shoot Alexander. I found no fault with him in the mountains, nor with his valour in the chase, nor his humble heroism at Tyche. But the man he serves is a plague, and he is just a noble symptom far too loyal for his own good. I point the gun at him, and let Rona fall unconscious to the floor.
Loon, he says. Arcos, I see Lorn gifted you the willow after all. Bold of you to say my grandfather's name after what Octavia did to him. You recall, yes, how she had Lilith Alpharan saw through his spine, from behind, like this.
He slowly moves his blade back and forth.
All my life I was compared to you. Cousin Lysander, perfect Lysander.
He looks me up and down.
You must be more than meets the eye.
Put down the blade and get on your knees, I say.
Perish the thought.
He levels his blade at me.
How about you pull that big iron from your boot and we settle who's the heir of Arcos?
Who is your favourite poet? When he does not answer, I choose for him. Ye labour for your fall with your own hands, not by surprise, nor yet by stealth, but with clear eyes, knowing the thing ye do. He sneers at the gun.
No honour.
No time. I shoot Alexander in the head.
Chapter 81. Darrow. Dark Age. The Lady Beatrice lies in darkness, except for the faint twinkling of lights through the windows of her west wing. My howlers land in force, Screwface taking a platoon through the top windows as I shoot a hole through the front door and thunder in with Thraxa and her warhammer.
Loon! I shout. Come out, you dumb little cur!
Thraxa slams her hammer through a pillar.
Come out and face the wee lass!
There is no answer. No sound except the stomping of my howlers upstairs and the faint warbling from the rotating crystal orb in the foyer. Its fractal light casts white snowflakes on the stone floor as we rush into the home. There's a shout from the west wing.
Gory hell,
Thraxa mutters as we enter Gliarastes' museum. I feel a tremor inside. There is a body on the floor. I stare down at it, and a maw of grief opens inside. The boy who entered my life as an arrogant lancer and through hardship became hero to an army lies in a pool of his own blood. He has been mutilated. Half his head is missing. Sightless eyes stare at the ceiling, mouth half open in surprise, as if he were wondering, really? Like this? There's a low moan. Rona limps from behind a model of the water colossus. Her face is nearly unrecognizable, her jaw shattered. She falls to her knees in Alexander's blood. Her scream tears me to tatters. How many years did they stand apart from each other behind me? How many precious few moments were they honest with each other? They were robbed of so much joy. Promised it, then robbed again. Rona, where is he? I whisper. Rona, where is Loon? She looks up at me with empty eyes and points up. I motion a howler forward. Get her to the Morning Star. Rona thrashes as the howler manhandles her off Alexander and drags her to the door. The house rumbles. Weapons fire upstairs from Screwface's platoon. His voice crackles through.
Eyes on! Shit! Dagger lodged a bullet. Shoot!
Homing mines on R6. Something detonates. We leap to the second level, bypassing the stairs. Screwface and his men fire down a hallway. Two howlers are down. There's a sucking sound. Screwface's platoon scatters, taking cover as a quarter of the house disintegrates. My armor absorbs the shockwave, but the wall does not. I stand as debris and dust swirl around me. A shape moves through a distant room and then disappears upward. Thraxa bursts after him.
He's got boots!
Screwface shouts. The pack follows. Clearing the debris cloud, my optics pick up a tiny shape racing for the city at incredible velocity. New boots. His lead is already half a kilometer. We rocket off in pursuit. I radio other elements held back from the evacuation to cut him off. Response teams rise from distant skyscrapers. Rip wings drop from the flyer lair. My army constricts around him. He banks left to avoid running into a rat legion squad from the mound. Mini-missiles streak after him and detonate against the sides of skyscrapers as he threads his way through the business district. Glass rains down on us as we follow in his wake. We bank left to cut him off when he passes through the eye of a circular tower. He sees our intent and shoots straight upward, firing a hole through the glass side of the building. He disappears inside. We hover around the building, forming a perimeter. I send four howlers in after him. Then I understand as Screwface banks down.
Ground floor! I bark.
Thraxa and 16 others rip downward with me, just as glass explodes outward from the second floor. He took a grav lift shaft down. I fire my pulse fist on full auto. Screwface flies underneath, taking slow aim. Chunks of concrete erupt as Loon weaves through our fire and takes off through a canyon of mercantile buildings, heading north. Damn, kid can fly, Thraxa mutters.
Thank Cassius, the pretty bastard, Screwface curses.
Is he here too? I pray not. If he's gone over. As Lysander gains altitude, I spare a look south of the city to the spaceport. The torch ship I ordered to destroy the spirit lowers itself midway up the Morning Star's hull to gain a firing solution. Too slow. Too damn slow. Just blow that EMP to hell! I radio them to shoot through the Morning Star. Loon's lead has diminished. We're barely 200 meters behind him, close enough to see him looking back over his shoulder at us with the naked eye. He wears light armor and a heavy old helmet.
What the? Screwface mutters. Boss, 9 o'clock.
Lysander's face blooms in the skyline. A broadcast to all the holoscreens. Not just that. Inside a passing skyscraper, the rooms fill with sudden illumination. The whole city glows with his message. Somehow, he hard-hacked the feed. I don't listen to his words. He'll be exhorting them to arms, as he watched me do on Phobos so many years ago. The attack will come from the inside first. He's heading for the prisoner camp in the shadow of the Hippodrome.
Fireballs bloom around the city camp. Not at the guard towers with their anti-personnel cannons or at the tank garages, but along the walls. Through the billowing smoke, men on fire flail in chaotic dances. From the sky they look like lightning bugs in fog. More explosions go off across the city. Not one near the heavily defended shield generator. My targeting system registers a lock on Loon's grav boot's thermal signature, and I fire my 6 mini missiles. Vapor trails scar the air between us as they reel him in. Then he seems to divide, impossibly.
Bailed out! Screwface calls.
Lysander's grav boots carry on without him as he falls barefoot from the sky. The missiles streak after the boots and detonate with a white flash. Lysander plummets downward, end over end, before crashing into the central pool of the water gardens. We overshoot him, and by the time we bank around, it is too late. Warning lights appear on my holo display, indicating rapidly changing electric and magnetic fields. A black pupil spawns at the center of the morning star as the lights of the ships wink out. Dark is the tide that rolls over the spaceport and the city, swallowing the phalanxes of tanks and Drakenjägers upon the field of Phaethion. It plunges the office spires, the hippodrome, the mound, and the great shield generators into darkness. Above, the iridescent shield that protected us against Atalantia flickers, and then goes off. The glittering cloak of flyers that drifted over the city glitters no more, and the ships become indistinct shadows as they plummet from the sky. We fall with them.
Chapter 82. Lysander. This summons legions. Heliopolis, city of the sun, lies in darkness. Darrow and his howlers disappear from the sky as their grav boots fail and they plummet down into shadows. Ships crash across the skyline without the dignity of balls of fire or white flashes from overloading reactors. I swim to the edge of the pool and jump down to the next level of the fountain, nearly losing hold of the horn of Helios as I drop down. There's a terrific crash from above as a troop carrier collides with the head of Poseidon, breaking off his right ear and tearing the carrier in two. One piece slams down into the topmost pool plate. The second spins through the air, passing less than 10 meters over my head. Half 100 men are still strapped into their seats. Their faces pass close enough I can see the acne on a brown's forehead before they smash into a building below. Water rains down on me. I look up. Over my head, the topmost plate of the gardens is cracking under the weight of the larger half of the carrier. I jump from the pool to the one beneath just as the topmost plate gives way, and 100 tons of marble and ship smash down on the pool beneath. It becomes an avalanche of stone and water and ship collapsing each plate, gaining on me as I jump frantically down the monument. I hit the ground level of the plaza and roll, barely outracing the debris that crashes down behind me. Chunks of rock the size of horses roll across the plaza, crumpling the bodies of bystanders and splintering trees. Something hits me hard in the back of the skull, and I go sprawling. Blood leaks down my back when I regain my feet. Dust billows all around. I search until I find the horn, then I run. Somehow, running in the darkness through the bedlam, I find the Via Triumphia. Rising legionnaires shout to one another in the black streets. I jump, grab the lip of a low wall, and scramble up till I'm on the rooftops. There I strip open my rucksack and change into lightweight boots. I wrap the loyalist razor around my left arm and try Alexander's better-crafted blade. Its response to my touch is exemplary. The whip cracks as it lashes out to wrap around the metal support of an overhead solar array. I swing out across the gaps between the roofs and toggle the razor into a blade. It releases as it cuts through the array, and I land on the other side. More arrays fall behind me as I swing north over the dark streets with the horn of Helios. The mayhem of the prison break is illuminated in stuttered flashes of gunfire. With electricity flowing, those prisoners taken in the Battle of the Ladan were at the mercy of the rising. Now gold and obsidian athletes scale the walls and tear their low-color guards to ribbons with their bare hands. I keep well clear. I can't mobilize them in the chaos on foot. Exeter and Glerastes' servants will have laid the charges on the pen housing my Praetorians. They may already be underway. I'm the laggard here. I vault another roof, almost impaling myself on a clothesline pole as I head breakneck for the Hippodrome. I was meant to land in the center of the arena, where loyalists would be waiting, but Alexander ruined my timing and jeopardized my initiative. Darrow was in pulse armor. The lack of electrical assistance will paralyze the weaker howlers under the armor's weight, but not soldiers like Darrow or Thraxa. He'll wake in some arcade or upon some roof, surrounded by chaos from which no man could possibly salvage a victory. But Darrow built his legend on such moments. The EMP wave went farther than expected. I can't see the lights of Atalantia's ships in orbit. How far did it go on the ground? How long till she moves more elements in? Given time, Darrow will summon some martial necromancy. So when I come south for his army, it must be with shock and awe. I use a market stall awning to slow my descent as I swing from the rooftops down to ground level and weave through dead automobiles outside the Hippodrome. Loon! I shout as I approach the main pedestrian entry arch at a run. Invictus! Someone replies. A dozen mid-color loyalists with gas-powered rifles step out of the shadows. They wave me to the left, into an arcade beneath the stadium seats, where concessions are sold and bets made on race day. Gunpowder weapons crackle in the distance. I find the door to the subterranean stables unlocked. Two rising sentries lie outside it with holes in their heads. A wall of horse stench hits my nose as I burst from the stairwell into the stables. Lit by the eerie flames of torches, one of Glerastes' servants waits for me with a dozen obsidian stablehands in the proud race day livery of House Votum. "Hail Loon!" they say, falling to their knees on the straw-strewn floor. They rise again, staring at me in the low light, to tend the anxious herd of saddled sunbloods. None but obsidians could wrangle such intrepid beasts. I search their eyes. They are barely kin with those who follow Sephi. They know no other life but Mercury, no life but these horses, no life but service. I salute them as they fulfill their noble task, and extend my arms for the loyalists to buckle the waiting suit of armor to me. It is old gear, circuits long dead, bone white with a crude crescent welded onto the front and back. Glerastes is incorrigible. "So you're Cicero's blood of empire," I say to the horse, set out before the rest. For once, Cicero was not hyperbolic. It is as if every horse I have seen before this day, even Atalantia's prized creatures, were nothing more than early drafts of this ultimate creation. He towers over me, clearing 25 hands at the withers, with still more muscled shoulder to measure. His hooves are the size of dinner plates, his mane as brilliant an orange as his irises, his white coat dappled steel-grey. Haughty eyes watch me. He bucks his head as I approach, lifting the two obsidian stable-hands off their feet. When they wrangle him back down, I cut my hand and wave the blood over his nose so he can smell it. He tilts his head, his eyes searching mine. I bring my nose to his, as is the dangerous custom with sunbloods. He could snap off my face with ease, but I keep my voice soothing, and he lets me stroke his muzzle. With a snort, he bends his front legs in obeisance. The obsidians cheer. They had wondered if the horse would find me worthy. "Blood knows blood, my liege," their old stable-master rumbles. "He will bear you over a sea of slaves." The ramp used by charioteers to enter the Hippodrome slams down in a cloud of dust. Blood of Empire has been here before, even if I have not. His hooves paw the sand, impatient for the glory to which he has become entitled. It has been years since I've ridden a horse, and in all of human history, how many have graced the back of such a terrible prize as this? I fear disgracing this king of horses more than I do the coming violence. With an intake of breath, I grip the horn of Helios and dig my heels into his sides. It is like riding lightning. The ramp blurs past underneath. Suddenly we are upon the surface of the hippodrome. No sea of faces awaits us, no adulation. Only a black sky, the empty stadium, and a ragged band of men jogging across the sand in tattered uniforms, Roan and Kalindora at their lead. The loyalists who led the attack on the Republic prison led them here for me. The Praetorians and Kalindora are shocked to find me alive. I spare no time for pleasantries as I circle them atop Blood of Empire. "Upon Luna, upon Earth, upon Mars, they say that the Praetorian Guard is dead," I shout, "that they have faded into the maw of history like morning fog over the sea, that nothing remains but the memory of the giants that once walked the worlds. Roan T. Flavinius," I cry, "before all things, what are the Praetorian Guard?" "Equestrians," he bellows. "And what is your duty?" "To protect the blood of Loon." "Will you ride with me today, Roan T. Flavinius?" "With honour, my liege." "Are you a memory?" I ask the Praetorians as blood continues to canter around them. "No." "Are you giants?"
"Yes."
"Will you ride with me today, for the glory of your forebearers, for the resurrection of the society, for the honour of the guard? Will you ride with me?"
"Yes," they roar.
Only Kalindora remains silent. I take the horn of Helios from the saddle and blow a sonorous note, and from the belly of the hippodrome the herd of Votum, pride of Heliopolis, stampedes upward under a black sky. The stable hands bear up crates of weapons provided by the loyalists, and when my Praetorians are mounted, Kalindora walks up beside me with a look of disapproval. The left sleeve of her prisoner jumpsuit hangs slack, the arm darrow cut off, rotting in the desert. But her sword arm looks restless. "What a hunger for blood you have acquired in the desert," she says. "Did you survive that sandstorm just to die in these streets? If we wait for Atalantia..."
"We will be at her mercy. Is that why you brought me the Praetorians?"
She does not reply.
"He will win whose army is animated by the same spirit throughout its ranks. The society needs victory, not a slaughter. Too long have the rabble had a monopoly on glory. Today we reclaim it. I would have the Love Knight at my side as we do."
I extend the loyalist razor to her. With a growing smile, she reaches forward.
Chapter 83. Darrow. Hazard Bedlam. Thump, thump. Distant screams and rage. The shrieking of metal on metal. In the darkness, flashes of flailing limbs, gnashing teeth, screaming mouths. I watch the violence painted in fragmented impressionist brushstrokes. My armor is dead. My helmet's internal screen black. Vision now constricted to the narrow duroglass emergency slits in the helmet's eyes. Beyond my helmet is frenzy. They beat on my armor with fists, hammers, blocks of masonry, fence poles, and all manner of improvised urban weaponry. They fell on me after I crashed through a storefront and struggled up from the debris, my legs snarled by electrical wires. First it was two, then two became a mob. Now I cannot move for the mound of humanity atop me. They besiege the Skiantos-made armor with anything they can find. A brown street cleaner sits on my chest, hammering a long piece of rebar into the joints with a chunk of masonry, desperate for my blood. A silver kicks at my groin till his foot breaks, and he hobbles away. A grey sits on my arm, trying to pry open my bald gauntlet so he can break my fingers one by one. Two old red women pin my head between them and start hammering at the eye holes with improvised chisels as they fumble for the emergency switch. They find it, but I've already locked it. Fortunately,
The armor is a tough nut to crack. I can only imagine they're doing the same to my downed men all over Heliopolis. Lysander has woken the sleeping giant that we kept alive with our meds. But beyond the screaming mob, the sky is black and empty of Atalantia's ships. Did the EMP reach all the way to orbit? I see no dreadnought lights above. My ships will be dead at the spaceport. Our shield down. This is the end. But I refuse to let the mob swallow me like it did my wife. The mob clears except for those holding me down, while several low colors stagger over with a block of masonry the size of a man. They hold it over my head and drop it. A ringing fills my ears from the internal concussion. The reinforced war helm dents but does not break. They get clever and drag me toward the local park, making a hideous parade, where they hold me down before a tall, headless statue of a Votum ancestor. They tie electrical cables around my arms and legs, and four teams pull my body taut as the rest of them loop the cable around the neck of the statue and begin to heave. It rocks on its pedestal, each heave bringing it closer and closer to its tipping point, after which several tons of marble will fall and test the metalworking of Martian forges. I wait as the four teams on my limbs strain and sweat, pulling against what they think is my strength, but is actually the reinforced skeleton of the armor. They waste their effort. I save mine for one desperate gambit. When the statue finally tips forward with a cheer from the mob, I roar and jerk as hard as I can with my right leg and right arm. The sudden force sends the teams of men stumbling forward, impossibly off balance. Then I see why. Several young Heliopolitan Reds smash into them from behind, knocking them off their feet. Still, they don't let go of the line. In a sudden explosion of pure force, the muscles of my right leg and right arm pull for everything they're worth against the teams. They're jolted forward, even as the men on the left keep pulling, helping me drag them into the path of the teetering statue. The timing is almost comedic. Several tons of stone make wet, boneless sacks of men. The teams on the left stop pulling, suddenly appalled by the sight of pulverized men and the bath of gore it entails. It is nothing to me. I unravel myself and stand in the dead, heavy armor. That they are not the same mob that butchered Daxo and mutilated my wife does not matter. I kill them all. The brown street cleaner rushes for me with his piece of rebar. My punch is slowed by the weight of my unpowered armor, but not by much, and I am still the war god Mickey carved, using all his infernal devices. I need no razor for this mindless dreck. This man is tiny. My metal fist collapses the side of his skull and shatters vertebrae. I lift the silver who kicked my groin by his throat and squeeze until I feel spine. I shatter a man's femur with a stomp and collapse his sternum into his heart as I march over him to break a woman's jaw. Rib cages crackle under armored boots like twigs as I tread through them in systematic slaughter. As a mob, they were a single organism. In fear, they divide. In death, they become lonely as I weave them into my twitching meat carpet. When all have fled or died, there is no one left to kill but a convulsing silver boy who huddles by what remains of his father underneath the statue. One sight of his wide eyes and slack jaw and desperate begging stops me like a wall. Seeing myself through his eyes, I am disgusted. So I wheel away, back into my world. The Reds who came to my aid stand watching me. There are six of the sun-baked laborers, not a one older than 20. They stand with their fists in a salute. I open an external pouch manually and find the helm key. I insert it into the collar until a latch pops. I roll back the wolf's head helm and suck down the fresh air. The young Reds stare up at me,
They might have thought they recognized my armor before, but now they see my face, and they take a step back in fear. I lost my razor on the rooftops. Find it. By the time the skinniest of them returns with my sling blade in his trembling hands, another crowd has formed down the street. They are trying to decide whether it's worth rushing me. I take the blade from the boy. They see its shape. They run. I nod to the red and, weighed down by 40 kilos of dead armor, rush to find my men. My miracle has turned into bedlam. Heliopolis is in chaos. Screams drift over the city. The streets are pitch dark. Gunshots crackle from conventional arms. Down ships smolder and send black clouds of smoke twirling up into the darkness. Bands of citizens armed with improvised weapons answer Loon's call and begin to rove the streets, dragging sympathizers from their doorways to stab metal in their guts or cave their heads in with rocks. A band of rubble-armed Heliopolitan high colors eyes me down a boulevard before carrying on, looking for easier kills. Each street is a new horror. I watch from a stone balcony looking down into an arcade as one of my citizen outreach patrols is cornered by a mob. With their pulse rifles dead, they have only their long utility knives to protect them. The mob keeps their distance and stones them to death before I can find a way down. I encounter bands of my men and frantic stragglers in the streets. Six have conventional weapons. By the empty magazine pouches, I see they've been using them. Most stragglers come from downed ships or local strong points. Panic grips the army. When they hold their ground, armies suffer, but when they retreat hysterically, they die. We can't all retreat at the same time. Guessing Lysander's force, when it comes, will cut off my 2 million support troopers billeted in the city, I order a Red Centurion to send runners to the other strong points and tell them to marshal at the Water Plaza. I follow the directions of a medicus who says he saw the howlers forming up in a square nearby. Before I make it there, I'm drawn by the glow of a fire in the mouth of an alleyway. Turning the corner, I find a gang of high-color youths standing over someone in armor, dumping mechanical oil on the blaze they've set. They take off running when they see me. I look around the alley for something to put out the blaze. Shouting comes from the street. Three White Fleet pilots, bleeding from a crash landing, tear around the corner, chased by a dozen men with clubs and a young gold with his heirloom family razor. They skid to a stop as they see me standing there covered in blood. I pull my razor, and they run. They'll find more of my men, so I hunt them down. In the armor, I'm too slow to catch the gold and a red, but I kill the rest from behind. The pilots have put out the blaze by the time I return. I brush the sand they piled on Thrax's armor and twist the hidden emergency release. She's not breathing. The flames would have prevented oxygen from entering her helmet. I perform mouth to mouth until she gasps against me. "I'm Prime," she says, eyes still wild. "I'm Prime! Get off!" She sits up in a daze and looks around at the darkness in ill temper. "That little odious shit. The ships? Dead. Seems the EMP hit orbit, too. No telling the range. I'll wring that overbred prat's neck. We gotta find him first." I help her to her feet, and she staggers with the pilots and me to the square. We find Screwface and most of the other howlers giving orders to several thousand infantry from a dozen different legions. "Boss!" Screwface shouts over the chaos. He rushes to me. "What's what?" I ask, as Thraxa helps me roll open my helmet. "Hazard bedlam," he says. "Whole city looks like. Ships too. Strong points are solid, but there's shuttles down all over the city. We got half the pack looking for you. Been sending out teams of them and bringing the wounded back here." He nods to the wounded at the far side of the market as the rest of the howlers form a semicircle around me. For a moment, I feel as if I am back at the Institute, though of their number only Screwface still has the stink of dead horse about him. Not for the first time, I'm thankful for my peculiar education. I know what to do when the lights go out.
The city is lost, but looks like the EMP hit orbit too, I tell them. It'll be hours before those dreadnoughts are back online. The fact that the skies are empty means her ground forces got hit, given the range. She'll have to bring her other ships from Picket or Farside to send armor, but once it comes, she'll have 2,000 years of tech on us. Then it's game over. We have to get as many men out of the city and into the mountains as we can before Atalantia brings those ships around. We have far less than an hour. I sketch a quick map of the city and the dirt with my sling blade, making triangles for armories holding conventional weapons. They crouch to see it better in the gloom. I draw a circle for the Hippodrome to the northeast. Lysander knew the EMP range. If he were practical, he'd hold for reinforcements. But he's going for glory. He'll try to take the city while Atalantia is knocked out. He landed here. I draw a rectangle to the south for the water plaza. The POWs were held here. I draw an X west of the Hippodrome, north of us. Soon we'll have several hundred thousand veteran troops pouring south with unknown armaments. I mark several circles 5 kilometers south of the Hippodrome, 2 south of us. These are our support barracks and administrative offices. They have not yet been evacuated. I sent runners to tell them to move south en masse. The fleet is dead, so they'll be heading for the mountain tunnels. They are hackers, medici, clerks, engineers, orderlies. Those prisoners are Iron Leopards and 20 Fulminata, some of the toughest sons of bitches in the Corps. With no tech, those obsidians and gulls will be murder machines. We will not let them catch our friends. They've held us up, now we get their backs. 6 main boulevards lead south. We will barricade them and hold the line here. I draw a line across the sand south of the water plaza. X. On that line, what remains of my infantry in the city will die to buy the rest time. The strong points have gunpowder weapons and grenades, but only enough for 1 man in 10. Give them to the grey and red snipers. All guns should be on the rooftops. Expect the gulls to be running the roofs, so fortify your men the best you can between the plazas, and give them melee support. Remember, they can jump streets. Use your Dark Age training. This isn't the first time gear's been down. You fight a gold alone, you die. Fight together. I give a boulevard apiece to 4 different howlers, putting Screwface on the right flank, nearest the tunnels and farthest from the mound. And what about you, boss? He asks. I put my finger in the center of the map at the water gardens. Thraxa and I will hold the Via Triumphia. Lysander is too young to go anywhere else. If he wants to make a name for himself slaughtering my men, he has to go through me. If your line breaks, do not head for the tunnels. It's too far. Their gulls will run you down. Retreat to the mound. We'll make our stand there. I look into their faces. Not a man or woman amongst them expects to survive the hour. But as the waiting has ended, so too has the fear. Not one quibbles or shies from duty. I could not be prouder. If I do not see you at the mound, I will meet you in the vale. Godspeed. I grab Screwface as the rest disperse. Be safe. He just laughs.
Legion!
Thraxa roars. All across the market, the infantry slam their heels together and raise their fists as we jog past.
Hail Libertas! Hail Reaper!
Chapter 84. Darrow. Meat Straw. Fragments of scattered legions join my procession as we rush to secure the Via Triumphia, swelling our numbers to upwards of 20,000, if I had to guess. 5,000 join us from the district's strong point, bearing crates of gunpowder weapons, which are dispersed to our snipers and riflemen. We have 600 working guns in total, 15 gas-powered grenade launchers. Though they are little more than clubs now, many cling to the energy weapons that never made them equal to gulls on the killing field, but at least gave them a chance. Conventional rounds just don't pack the same punch. To give our men pole arms,
We hew down fences and signposts with our razors as we pass. Another swell of men come from the now useless artillery batteries. Thraxa waves to a little pink girl who fogs her apartment's window as she watches us. We have failed her, like we failed those red boys who came to my aid. Soon they will know the mines, and she will be returned to the gardens, where she will know only the pleasure of others, and one day think of her childhood when the rising came as little more than a fantasy. We make it to the choke point just as scouts from Lysander's force reach the rooftops on the other side of the water plaza. Through the legs of the mighty statue of Poseidon, I see them moving roof to roof. The fastest have already summited the stone wreckage of Poseidon's fallen plates. They double back to report our movements as our snipers start picking them off. "So he is pushing," Thraxa says, "that unctuous twat. Why wouldn't he just wait for armor?" "He wants to make a name for himself in slaughter," I say. "I thought better of that boy." "Of course you did. Severa was right. Should have ended the line in the maw." Together we look north. The cityscape lies in darkness. The hippodrome like the bent head of a shadowy giant. Through the roots of those buildings, Lysander's army will be moving south. The Golds rushing ahead for glory and revenge. No doubt thinking our humane treatment of their radiation sickness to be some kind of genetic moral weakness on our part. The Obsidians won't be far behind. And then, a sea of veteran grey killers from the shores of Venus, the furnace of Mercury, the old lands of Earth, the megahoods of Luna, and even the highlands of my home. All coming to kill my men. Should we not have fed them? Should we not have healed them? The water plaza itself is a kilometer by kilometer square of white marble, in the center of which Poseidon stands over whitewashed sandstone and flowering sun blossom trees. The fallen plates make a stack of rubble to the north, but between Poseidon's legs, the plaza is flat and open. The Via Triumphia encircles the water gardens in a roundabout littered with dead vehicles. I send snipers into the buildings on the southern edge of the plaza and on the rooftops, putting my howler snipers in two stone bell towers and atop a triumphal arch. Gunshots crackle as they continue picking off Loon scouts. I see the men of our adjacent force climbing the rooftops to the east. A thin line of resistance forms across Heliopolis. Far to the west, gunfire echoes. Screwface is already under assault, Thraxa says. If Loon masses there, we'll be flanked. He won't. I want you on the roof. She looks at our few Golds and Obsidians. You need me as a bulwark to hold the line. We're not going to be able to hold it, I say. But that boy out there can rally the whole bloody damn system behind him if we let him become a hero. We're here to kill him. I shout at a group of three Rat Legion snipers. The Reds bob up to me like jackrabbits. You any good? I ask them. The dourest of them answers first. It's our calling, sir. I take the gas rifles I reserved in case we ran into more howler snipers. The three men drop their improvised weapons and cradle the guns like diamonds. I toss them the armor-piercing magazines. There are 66 bullets in these magazines. All 66 are for Loon. I point to the three windows. I want you there, there, and there. Expect snipers. Do not reveal your position, not for any reason, until you have him in your sights. Do you understand? Do you know what he looks like? Thraxa asks. They nod. His face was on the broadcast before the EMP, the handsome one says in the same accent. Two of them even look alike. You all brothers? I ask. Yes, sir. If this goes tits up, use the roofs to get to the mound. Bag me a Loon. They take off. Thraxa stares across the plaza. I put a hand on her shoulder. If they don't drop him, crush his skull on the way down. Got it. She jogs off. Blood sprinkles down from above. I look up and see a man falling from a rooftop. A centurion shouts a warning for enemy snipers.
Where the hell did they get gunpowder?
Someone shouts. Where else but from the Heliopolitans? Muzzles flash on northern rooftops. As the sniper duel rages, the golds and obsidians help me drag abandoned ground transports and civilian hovercraft just shy of the southern mouth of the Triumphia, where it exits the plaza. We've blocked only half of the 50-meter-wide artery when a spotter calls to Thraxa on a rooftop, and she calls down to me.
Enemy cavalry spotted!
I look to the air instinctively. It is empty. And then I hear the thunder on the ground. My insides twist. He's emptied the stables. The last time I heard hoofbeats and felt anxiety was nearly 16 years ago. The oceanic sound of an army shouting with one voice drifts from the northern city. I can barely make out the words.
Invictus! Per ordo!
Form up! I bellow. Form up! To me! To me! Reds to the roofs! Reds to the roofs! Thraxa!
As the Reds rush up the stairwells along the Triumphia, Thraxa peers down at me.
Let them hit, then fall on! Red rain!
She understands what I mean and ducks as a fusillade of enemy fire chews into the facades of the buildings. The howlers in the bell tower are gone, killed already. Long shadows sprint along the rooftops west and east of the plaza, hurtling 6-meter-wide streets as easy as children hop over brooks. Some are shot mid-leap and spin down between the buildings, but in a world without electricity, the peerless guard are kings. They clash into my rooftop elements along our flanks. The sea of voices is a creeping tide.
Loon, Invictus! Loon, Invictus! Per ordo, per ordo!
I roll up my helmet. On the ground, every legionnaire without gunpowder rushes for the meager security of our barricade. They look to each other, mouthing the dreaded word, loon. I stand in the empty center around a lone family hovercraft. My 13 golds and 40 obsidians cluster around me in their dead armor to make a hedgehog of bristling razors. I wish Alexander were with me. I wish Sevra had my back. I wish Ragnar were here, and Orion in the sky. But these are my brothers and sisters, too. We toggle the razors so they take on their leanest and longest form, nearly a meter and a half. Not nearly long enough. The low colors gather on our wings, 60 men deep behind the vehicles, some few holding pole arms of metal fence posts or signs, and they shiver in dread as they see what's coming. Even the droning death chant of the obsidians stutters when they hear the sonorous lament of the Initium horn. Once, on a mission for Nero, I had the privilege of witnessing something no low red of Mars had ever seen before. A race in the Hippodrome of Heliopolis. The sun was bright, the streets filled with music, honey wine, and the smell of spiced ginger locust sweet. Out of respect for my patron, the votum allowed me backstage before the Initium horn to see the riders preparing. In the shadowy recesses of the underground stables, I saw sunblood stallions for the first time. Until then, I'd only known the horses of the Institute, animals of 16 hands. They were terrifying enough to my eyes, but they are little more than donkeys compared to sunbloods. Weighing nearly 1 ton and 23 hands tall, with bone-pale coats and fiery manes, capable of speeds up to 80 kilometers per hour at full gallop, the beasts I saw race were barely horses at all. Monsters, I thought, feeling a kinship with that unnatural bloodline. Beautiful monsters, made for one purpose. The race I watched ended in catastrophe, with the winner's prize stallion biting off the head of a competitor when he came at the winner waving a whip. The gold owners were horrified, but how the crowd cheered. How did I ever think these people would embrace liberty? Now, 200, 300, 400, maybe more, of the most powerful chariot horses that have ever lived have come to war. They rumble into the northern mouth of the Via Triumphia in an avalanche of white muscle and fiery manes and multi-hued festival saddles ridden with terrible grace by the equestrians amongst the prisoners of war, greys and golds. They'll go through us like an anvil through glass. But glass can cut. And if we run, it'll be massacre. Stand fast! I roar at my veterans, conjuring the only trick I have left. Bullets smack into our armor, sending some stumbling. Grenades detonate amongst the horses, sending some screaming. When I give the command, line, form a line 3 deep. When I give the command, flat, go flat and hold your razor like this. Trust your weapon. Trust your armor. Stand fast. Gunshots rattle through the plaza, ours and theirs. Men are kicked back from windows and duck on the rooftops from precision shots by Lysander's escorts, dying as they desperately fire down at the horses. Riders spill from saddles. Horses go down with shattered fetlocks and inhuman screams. One takes more than a dozen shots to the neck before it falls full speed into a transport, crumpling the hull and throwing its rider dozens of meters through the air for him to land in a human smear. But the tide does not break. It quickens. The sound of thunder is all, rattling my eardrums, filling my gut with dread.
Line!
My cluster of armored men unfolds to stand in a thin line at the center of the formation. Then I see him amongst them, riding at the fore of the charge in white armor, the reins in one hand, a razor in the other. The boy whose grandmother I killed in front of him. The boy I spared for the sake of decency. The boy Azure trained and Cassius raised, who looked me in the eye and mocked me with lies, before returning here like a demon to haunt those foolish enough to practice mercy. Frozen in time atop a monstrous steed, bald from radiation, face set not with vanity but grim determination, leaning forward in a saddle that flutters with ribbons of 100 colors, he looks magnificent. His head snaps back. For an exultant moment, I think my snipers have put one through his brain. But then his head comes forward, scarlet along the side. His mouth a wide rictus as he lowers himself to his horse, and it explodes forward, faster than all the rest. 2 more rounds spark off his armor. I tremble in fear as my horizon becomes one of flaring nostrils, frothing muzzles, and trampling hooves. 12 horses fill my field. Lysander weaves right, around my hedgehog and toward the frailer wings. In the age of starships, you forget what animals can do to men. Lysander reminds me as he plunges 40,000 kilograms of horsepower through the wings of my line. The sudden acceleration of horse flesh into human bodies creates shearing forces as the momentum of the charge meets the inertia of the internal organs. Men are literally pulverized from the inside out. Organs tear. Brains hemorrhage, blood vessels rupture, spines collapse backward. Even as the friction of the corpses slows the horses, they do not stop their killing. Hooves flatten skulls. Teeth of racehorses trained for the conflict of the hippodrome snap off faces. Screams turn to gurgles as men are spun through the blender of hooves, manage to crawl free, only to have their backs broken by the next steed. The horses bear down the center of my line.
Flat!
I fall backward before the onrushing wave, razor held in both hands, its pommel at my belly button. With the blade that can cut through 10 centimeters of starshell armor, sticking 1.5 meters into the air. 53 other armored men do the same a bare second before the horses trample us. incandescent explosions of lights in my head. Unreal weight and sound. Hooves slamming into my armor, my helmet. Underbellies, tails, bottoms of bare feet, of boots, as I'm kicked and trampled in an unending stampede. But even horses made of 1 ton of muscle and bone and blood cannot stomp through armor meant to withstand pulse fire, or run through a field of razor blades undaunted. We shred them. Gore, like I've never seen, pours down on us. The screams of dying horses are worse by far than those of men. Yet the herd animals keep coming, running straight over the blades so thin that in the darkness they cannot see them as they sever bones in half and open bellies and muscled chests so cleanly that the horse's momentum carries them like cannonballs past us to spill shrieking and dying into the back of their fellows who crushed our wings. Any Roman ground commander worth his salt would tell you that robbing the velocity from a cavalry charge is the first step to killing it. With the Via Triumphia turned into a charnel house of dying horses and dying men, I stumble to my feet. Blood obscures my eye slits. A horse on its side with its guts spilling out kicks me so hard in the helmet that my Duraglass eye holes finally crack and I go down. Try to stand. My neck is sprained, maybe fractured. Something hits me from behind, and I fall. Through the fragmented vision of my cracked visor, I see a horse coming at me at full gallop. I throw myself to the side just as a gold rider leans sideways off her saddle, nearly parallel with the ground, and swings her razor down. The blade peels a chunk of metal from the back of my thigh, then skips sideways, and she's past. I hack blindly at the back legs of the horse, but don't see if I connect. That was Kalindora, the love knight herself. Out of respect for her treatment of our prisoners, I kept her with her men. Now I pay for it. Someone hauls me up. A horse chest hits me from the side, and I'm lifted off my feet, kicked under several others, and spun around and around until I crawl free and find a wall to guard my back. On my feet, but unable to see, I press my emergency release and rip off my helmet. The sound is unreal, indescribable, like an animal caught in a blender, except it's thousands of us in here. Horses shattering men as they kick in their death throes. Riders crushed underneath or thrown clean to be swallowed by my men. Horses whinnying in the plaza, terrified at the sight. For all we have killed, more than 200 Sunbloods wheel about in the swirling mass of bodies, their riders slashing down, the horses stomping on the unlucky fallen, or breaking through the lines to encircle my other elements, even as their infantry advances through the plaza to pound more meat into the straw. The world takes on a slow, soupy feel. Only a fraction of my force is gold and obsidian. Without armor, without technology, the vast gulf that separates the races becomes measured in the carnage an individual gold can wreak against lesser creatures. Their skin is tougher, their bones and thick skulls like armor. I see one of my greys hit a gold thrown from his horse full on in the back of the head with his rifle, only for the gold to wheel around and with a single punch break the neck of a man who survived 10 years of war. Two reds fire full clips into a gold in a prisoner jumpsuit. He closes in and kills them before stumbling on to kill 4 more before finally expiring. In my pocket of peace amidst the battle, I feel the coolness of Pax's key on my chest, the weight of my wife's gift in my hand, the memory of all the goodness my men have inside them, how they laugh over cards, how they smile when entering a liberated city for the first time, how they hustle when beside a gold comrade to show they are his equal, how they weep when they see their families at the spaceport. And I watch as they are butchered by the score, and their conviction that all men are created equal is made into a mockery by the physical absurdity of the golds atop their monsters. There is a glee in their killing, a horrid joy teaching this chattel, this jabbering mass of uppity slaves, who their masters are. Bend, bow, break. I see Lysander amidst the fray, blood spattered atop that monstrous horse, youthful and killing with uncommon grace. His bodyguards mill around him, cutting down any who rush his flanks. I see it so clearly. All his life before him, all the worlds on their knees, rejoicing their return supplication as they embrace their chains, so long as pretty, manicured hands hold the lead. His rise will summon a hideous tide of renewed romantic vigor that will not stop until my people, my wife, my child, are swallowed whole. And then he will smile from the humble throne war built and say he is their good shepherd. I gave him a choice long ago, a chance to live in peace, but he has returned to war. To see the boy become man scours the empathy in me. 10 years too late, he must die. My snipers no longer fire. Thraxa waits for my signal on the roof. I shape my razor from its long form to the sling blade. The dread monster rises in the belly of me. Laughter spews.